From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made 17 years ago in the state of Oregon. Oregon passed the Death with Dignity Act, allowing patients to choose the terms of their own death, terminally ill patients, that is. The goal was to provide terminally ill patients the choice to die more peacefully with prescribed medication surrounded by family and friends, again, if they chose. Since that law took effect 17 years ago, about 1,000 people with terminal illnesses have requested life-ending drugs. 4 other states have moved in Oregon's direction, including Washington State, Vermont, Montana, and New Mexico. New York is currently not among them. And now the case of 29-year-old Brittany Maynard is getting national attention. Maynard has what's been diagnosed as incurable brain cancer and was given 6 months to live back in April. She and her husband moved to Oregon to allow Brittany the opportunity to end her life on her terms. She had chosen November 1st, that's tomorrow, but this week she released a new video, and you're going to hear part of that video and her words coming up. Recently, 60 Minutes profiled the story of Barbara Mancini and her father. Barbara was arrested when her 93-year-old father took a large dose of morphine, attempting to die on his own terms, and she initially faced 10 years in prison for not intervening. Barbara Mancini is on the line with us now. Barbara, thank you for taking the time to join us.
Thank you, Evan.
In studio, we welcome Dr. Timothy Quill. He is the director of the Palliative Care Program at the University of Rochester Medical Center. Dr. Quill, nice to see you back here.
Glad to be here.
Well, let me start, Barbara, with a little bit more of your story. Your father, in February 2013, was 93 years old, and my understanding is he had kidney disease and cardiovascular issues, among others. Is that right?
Yes, there were several other medical conditions, too.
A lot of pain?
He was in pain every day.
And he was in home hospice care, is that correct as well?
That's correct.
All right, so he had asked for morphine and in February 2013, and kind of walk me through the process of what happened next.
Well, my father had been in home hospice care for 2 weeks before the hospice even provided any pain medicine. There's a definite issue of inadequate treatment of his pain. As he got closer to dying, his pain and his other symptoms worsened. And my father had fallen the night before, so he was in more pain than usual, and he asked me to hand him his bottle of morphine. It was a 1 ounce, partly filled bottle of morphine. Now, I had the dosing syringe in my hand. He removed the cap, and he quickly drank what was left. Now, there's a question whether his intention was to end his life or to and the severe pain he was in. But a hospice nurse arrived later, and I told her that he had drunk the morphine. She insisted that he be taken to the ER to be treated for an overdose. I resisted that because my father had made clear to all of us, and he had written advance directives that backed this up, that he did not want to have any life-prolonging treatment, and he made it clear to my family that he never wanted to go to a hospital. And because I resisted that, the hospice called 911, and police and paramedics arrived. They invalidated my father's advance directives. He was taken to the ER, and I was arrested right there in the house. And I was charged with aiding an attempted suicide, and I was prosecuted for a year on that charge.
You had faced a potential sentence, a term of 10 years in prison for that. I know that it eventually worked out for you about a year later, but I say work out in the oddest sense of the word, because you endured a year of this, but you were exonerated eventually. Yes, Barbara?
I was. I filed a petition of habeas corpus, which is a motion to dismiss. A judge evaluated both sides of the case. She determined that there was no evidence that my father was attempting to end his life, and she determined that there was no evidence that I assisted him in that supposed attempt to end his life. So she dismissed the charge, and that ended my prosecution.
But that's the legal decision. You have said, and I know you said on 60 Minutes, that in your mind he was trying to end his life, and you wanted to respect that wish.
Well, I didn't say in my mind he was trying to end his life. I wasn't sure of that. It certainly was a possibility. It absolutely was a possibility. And I had promised my father that I would respect what he wanted to happen at the end of his life. So, no, I didn't stop him from drinking it. Could I have? It's possible, but I didn't stop him.
But I think there will be a lot of people who say that it is offensive. The very idea that you could face a prison term when you're trying to follow your father's own wishes is offensive.
Absolutely offensive. And I don't know why people feel they can interject themselves into the personal medical decisions of people they've never met, and they don't know the degree of their suffering. And I think that's wrong.
By the way, Barbara, your father, when he was taken to the hospital, my understanding is they revived him for at least a short time, didn't they?
Yes, they gave him a medicine to reverse the effects of the morphine. That was not given until several hours after he took the morphine. So if his wife had been in immediate danger, that would have needed to be given immediately, because the way a morphine can cause you to die in an overdose is that you stop breathing. My father never stopped breathing. He was very drowsy. He was not unconscious. He was able to answer the question from a paramedic. The paramedic asked him if he was in any pain, and for the very first time, my father said no. So he received the reversal agent a number of hours after he drank his morphine. And he became more alert. He was furious that he'd been brought to the hospital. And he knew that I was in trouble, and he was pleading that, please don't get Barbara in trouble. Don't let her get in trouble. So he was very anguished over what had happened, and it's just heartbreaking.
Now, Dr. Quill, you were on this program in recent weeks, and we talked about the importance of advanced directives. And yet, in this case, you have a man, Mr. Yorshaw, who had an advanced directive. And you had Barbara Mancini, his daughter, saying, look at the advanced directive. He doesn't want life-saving care. You're not following it. And it turns out, apparently, in this case, it didn't help. Should we be surprised at that, Dr. Quill?
Well, this is a real comedy of bad medical care, except for it's a tragedy, really, because in point of fact, if he was really wanting to die, he should have been able to have a frank conversation with his health care providers about his suffering so that it could have been better addressed. Maybe some of his treatments that he's continuing might be prolonging his life. There are options that we could have provided potentially that might have helped him actually end his life earlier if he had been able to have that conversation frankly with his doctors. The problem that we have is that people are so afraid of the conversation that they don't have it, and then that forces patients and families often to do things out of desperation. I mean, again, if one is going to stop a treatment that's going to end one's life, you'd like to have that be thought through carefully, really openly discussed with a physician. And that's what can happen probably in Oregon and places where this option is legal. But it should happen in other places because the open conversation is absolutely critical.
Well, let's just state for the record here, again, we've got five states that have this kind of a law, New York not among them. I don't know of any movement in this state that's realistic in the legislature to change that. Do you, Dr. Quill?
New York State and the legislature is not going to change it. New York State and the referendum process is not going to change it. Referendums in New York State are very hard to bring about. Case law is still a possibility in New York State, similar to what happened in New Mexico. So that option is possible. Again, it would take the right case, the right plaintiffs.
But that's the most likely avenue in this state?
That would probably be the only short avenue in the foreseeable future.
Would you like to see it happen?
If we could find the right case to bring in, I think it's a good idea, because people are whether it's illegal or legal, people are facing the kind of conundrums that we're discussing right now on a regular basis. So just because it's illegal doesn't mean these dilemmas are go away.
And frankly, Dr. Quill, if it's illegal in this state, you look at the Barbara Mancini story, that can have a chilling effect. You have the question of legality to begin with. And so you may have patients trying to overdose intentionally, whether they're surrounded by family and friends or not, whether it's morphine or something else, because they can't have that conversation with their doctor, right?
The conversations, yes, they do it because they're desperate and they don't know what else to do.
But is that happening?
That is happening. And in fact, if we could teach doctors, even in New York State where this option is illegal. There are many options for helping people to more actively die better. Sedation, stopping eating and drinking, that can at least be explored openly because they're legal, and often give people choices that they didn't otherwise have. A lot of people, like Brittany Maynard, having the possibility of an escape is huge, that they may never exercise or they may postpone and postpone. But having the option gives them a sense of being in charge, which is a gigantic issue for many patients.
Yeah, and we're going to hear about that in just a moment. Barbara Mancini, let me turn it back to you and ask you that since your case has gained so much attention, not just through the recent 60 Minutes story, but I know there was a lot of attention before then. Has there been any movement in your state, or have you seen any movement elsewhere to enact any kind of change?
Well, in Pennsylvania, there has been a death with dignity bill introduced by State Senator Dayon Leach for the past 3 years. It just stays in committee. It never gets voted out of committee. So there's been no movement on that front. Senator Leach is introducing another bill again this year. And we'll have to see what happens with that. But I know in California, there is definite movement towards enacting a death with dignity bill. Whether that'll come through ballot initiative or legislation hasn't been decided yet. But I have been to California, and I've spoken to some groups out there in favor of enacting a death with dignity law. So it's starting to occur in other places.
If our listeners want to join the program with questions or comments, you can do so now. It's toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. We're talking to Barbara Mancini, whose father was 93 years old when he took a dose of morphine and very well might have been attempting to die in his own terms, and that led to a protracted legal battle. Because it was technically not legal in that state. We're looking at the case of Brittany Maynard in Oregon, and we're talking to Dr. Timothy Quill, who is the director of the palliative care program at the University of Rochester Medical Center. Dr. Quill, by the way, some of our listeners may be wondering, you're shutting the door on the notion of legislative possibility. Is that just through your experience that it's a non-starter in our legislature?
To be frank, our legislature has trouble doing really basic business a lot of the time, and to work your way through a complex issue like this is not going to happen in the legislature.
We saw just how difficult it was to get medical marijuana that was passed to the satisfaction of the medical community, and frankly, I don't know that it was passed to the satisfaction of the medical community this year. Is that fair?
I think the medical community is actually fairly satisfied with the compromise that was made, but this is a completely more complex issue, a lot more edges to this that are sharp and easy to get caught up on.
Well, let's update the Brittany Maynard story. And again, if you're not familiar, she's 29 years old and diagnosed with incurable brain cancer. Her doctors have indicated to her that they thought she would die from that cancer before the end of this year. She and her husband moved to Oregon to allow Brittany the opportunity to, as they say, die with dignity. She's been public. She's put out some videos, and in fact, they've created the Brittany Fund. It's at thebrittanyfund.org, in which they're trying to enact change elsewhere so that the rest of the country, and her, you're going to hear it in just a second. She's going to talk about this. But she put out a video a couple days ago that said she is not going to end her life tomorrow. I can't imagine being in the position where the whole country is just looking at, is she going to do it today or the next? It's just a terrible thing. But she indicated that she has been feeling good enough, enjoying day-to-day life enough that she's going to wait. She still plans to do it. But let's listen to Brittany Maynard from her video that was released this week talking about her decision and what she wants to see happen.
When people criticize me for not like waiting longer or, you know, whatever they've decided is best for me. It hurts because really I risk it every day that I wake up. And I do it because I still feel good enough and I still have enough joy and I still laugh and smile with my family and friends enough that it doesn't seem like the right time right now. But it will come because I feel myself getting sicker. It's happening each week. My goal, of course, is to influence this policy for positive change. And I would like to see all Americans have access to the same healthcare rights. But beyond that public policy goal, my goals really are quite simple, and they mostly do boil down to my family and friends, and making sure they all know how important they are to me and how much I love them.
All right, so that's Brittany Maynard. Barbara Mancini, I know you've been following her story. What do you think?
I fully support what she has done. I think she is a selfless, a courageous woman, and I'm very inspired by her.
Dr. Quill, when we see her, and again, it's tough to speak publicly about her story, but she kind of wants to be a spokesperson for this cause, and I gather that gives her some additional purpose to what's going on here. But when she says this week she's not going to choose tomorrow, that she's feeling good enough to prolong it, she immediately, unfortunately, there were some critics online saying, see, you shouldn't, this was never a good idea. You know, she's too scared. Life is too precious. And, you know, my first reaction is, who are they to decide? But even if Brittany Maynard never takes that prescription, and even if she dies from her disease, does the having the option change and matter?
Absolutely, to many people. So in Oregon, where this possibility is legal, one in six talk to their families about this possibility. One in 50 talk to their doctors about this possibility, and only one in 500 actually activate the possibility. A lot of people who get the prescription in Oregon actually ultimately don't take it, but that prescription for them is a security blanket, that if they get stuck in a tough position where their suffering becomes intolerable, they have an out. And I think so a lot of folks, Brittany Maynard has that security blanket, which for her is very important. If she never takes it and dies peacefully, fabulous. Fabulous. On the other hand, if she gets to a point where things are too rough and she is ready and all she can see in her future is suffering, then if she takes it, that is her choice to make. And that is, for people who care about this, an incredibly important option.
You admire her story?
I think it's very brave to go this public about it. Certainly there are all kinds of people who will weigh in, not knowing her at all, and will use her story on both sides for political reasons. But I think it's a very compelling story.
Right, let's take our first phone call, and this is Patricia in Irondequoit. Patricia, you're a hospice nurse, is that right?
Yes, I am.
Thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. As I listened to Brittany's video, it brings tears to my eyes to listen to what a brave, brave woman she is to take this very personal journey public. And one of my thoughts as I was listening is how important language is around this issue, because many people use the term assisted suicide to describe what Bethany and other people who make a conscious decision when to end their life with dignity. And this is absolutely not suicide. This is a conscious death, and it's a death of dignity and bravery. So I'd like to ask Dr. Quill his thoughts on how we can change the discussion to help people to become more comfortable talking about the inevitability of death and that death is part of our life process. I find that even at the end of life with my hospice residents, some of the families are still resistant to providing pain medication, to trying to force their loved ones to eat and drink because they have some sense that not eating and drinking is somehow painful. So I'd ask Dr. Quill his thoughts on how to educate people in a loving way around working through and acknowledging some of the fear that we all have around dying. And I can take your answers off.
Patricia, thanks. Thank you so much for the call. Dr. Quill, go ahead.
So I think it is a challenge. You know, we're living longer as Americans, and there's, you know, big meccas are all kind of trying to convince us that if we do the right thing or take the right medicine that we will live indefinitely. But there is also, I think, a little bit more openness to the conversation about about dying and what we might want that to look like for us. Hospice has done a huge service in terms of a little bit demystifying death and the dying process and making it less scary. I do think when we get into these kinds of cases, whether you call it suicide or not, does make a difference, because it really isn't. Suicide, from a meaning point of view, usually has to do with self-destruction. We think of people with mental illness, and we work extremely hard to prevent such suicides. This is a death that, in my mind, doesn't meet the criteria for a suicide. An example, if somebody's on a life support who's dying, they're on a ventilator and they're able to make decisions, and they decide they want to go off that ventilator because they're going to either die on the ventilator eventually or die when the ventilator stopped. We see them as being brave people. We say listen to your patient because they know what they want. But again, somebody suffering much more but not on a ventilator who starts talking about wanting to die, being ready to die. People, you know, if they invoke the possibility of a self-controlled death, then we get very conflicted and start calling it names. And it's really naming it. It's naming it in an adverse way. And I do think the language of physician-assisted death is probably better language. It's more descriptive. It's less controversial.
Okay. Before we get back to the phones, I want to air some of the other side, and certainly there is a large religious contingent that says death should be at God's hand and not our own. And then there is part of the medical community. 60 Minutes featured Dr. Ira Byock, who's a Dartmouth professor and someone who has become sort of a leading voice for better care toward the end of life, but against the notion of the death with dignity laws. And here's what Dr. Ira Byock told 60 Minutes. Let's listen.
There are certain things that people aren't supposed to do to one another. As absolutes, they are not okay. Doctors killing patients is not okay. You know, when a physician is involved in a suicide, it's a social action. And if you want to look at societies like Belgium and Netherlands, well, nowadays, people who have just lost interest in living or are clinically depressed are being euthanized legally. We are failing elders, chronically ill people, vulnerable people in America in so many ways. We are, you know, not treating people's suffering. We are making them feel undignified. Ask any boomer who's cared for their parents. They'll tell you that even for those of us who are doctors and nurses, it's really, really hard to get the basics of care for your frail loved one met. We're not going to treat your pain. We're not going to train your doctors to counsel you. We're going to basically ignore you. But don't worry, because if the time comes when you're feeling hopeless, we can write that lethal prescription. In what world is that a progressive, positive development?
All right, first of all, Dr. Quill, I've never met Dr. Byock, and I certainly respect his credentials. I think that in some ways he created a straw man when he invoked Belgium and the Netherlands, because in this country, at least, we're not handing out prescriptions to people who have a bad day at work on a Tuesday to end their life. We're talking about terminally ill diagnosis and then giving the option, first of all. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Belgium and the Netherlands, when he invoked Belgium and the Netherlands, he's indicating there's a rash of people just ending their lives because they're feeling down. Is that fair or unfair?
It's an overstatement. You know, Belgium and the Netherlands are... they have a whole different view of public policy than we do in the United States. In the United States, we try to hammer out every detail and try to get it into law, and then if you test it, you have the risk of going to jail. In these countries, it's a little bit more flexible how they hammer it out. They allow the practice to wander a little bit and try to find its edges, and then they try to set up laws to sort of find out the middle ground. So they have a much more easy time finding the middle ground. United States gives very loud voice to the edges, but has real hard time finding the middle ground.
Now, he's also saying doctors cannot be killing patients. Is that language, again, overstatement to you?
Well, it's demagoguery in my view. Now, there are I know Ira very well. We work together in many settings nationally. And the part of his argument that I am totally in agreement with is we need to advance palliative care across the spectrum, make it available to people who are dying and also people who are really sick, because we have the ability to address most kinds of suffering if we put the expertise there, and we're making progress in that regard. Having said that, will palliative care and hospice solve every issue at the end of life? It just, frankly, does not. It solves most of them, but there are tough cases with people getting the best possible care. And again, and every hospice program knows this, and every palliative care program knows this. Now, doctors shouldn't intentionally end life, you know, as he would put it, shouldn't kill patients. Well, we are having conversations with people all the time around ventilators about whether to stop their ventilator or not. Again, if you did it against somebody's will, that would be killing them, right? But if they're choosing to go off a ventilator, that's allowing them to die. So again, this language can be used in very, manipulative ways. Similarly, sedation. We do a lot of sedation in these tough cases because you can't let people suffer in extreme ways. And when that's something we've agreed upon legally is okay. Now, some of these patients really do want to die. We are really helping them to die. And we can pretend like we're not, but we are. Not because we want to, because we really have to.
Barbara Mancini, Dr. Byock on 60 Minutes called your father's case a classic example that, in his view, your father didn't get good enough care to ease his suffering, and that he shouldn't have been allowed to die. He should have had better care, and that's what Dr. Byock wants to see. What do you think?
Well, there's no question his hospice care was inadequate. His pain was severely undertreated. So I absolutely agree with Dr. Byock that provision of hospice care needs to be excellent all around and not just sporadically. But I do not feel that should go against the argument of having legal aid in dying. I think both can be available, and they both will provide good end-of-life care to dying patients. Now, I can't sit here and say that my father would have utilized aid in dying if it were legal in Pennsylvania, although I do believe strongly he would have wanted the choice. He was a fiercely independent person. He had focused convictions on how he wanted to live. And aside from the pain he was suffering, he was unable to do the things that made his life meaningful as a result of his terminal disease. So having the choice, as you have pointed out before, is a huge thing to help people cope with their end of life.
In other words, Barbara, you don't think it's mutually exclusive to improve end-of-life care but also offer the option that Oregon and some other states do?
I think having legal aid in dying will improve end-of-life care wherever it's legal. I know that the relationship between hospices and Compassionate Choices in Oregon is a good one, and hospice care in Oregon is very good. There was a recent article in the Washington Post that talked about how families are left in the dark regarding knowing how to choose the hospice for their terminally ill loved one. There are no federal databases that help you with that choice. So it's kind of a stab in the dark if you get the correct hospice. So absolutely, end-of-life care regarding hospice and palliative care has a long way to go to be improved to where it's useful and good for all patients. But that should not exclude legal aid in dying. I think both are a part of good medical care.
All right, what we're going to do now is take a very short break, and we're going to get right back to your phone calls. If you're just joining us, we're talking about the question of how to define death with dignity. We're looking at the Brittany Maynard story from Oregon. We're talking to Barbara Mancini, who was in jeopardy of being prosecuted legally when her 93-year-old father took a dose of morphine, and Barbara was accused of potentially assisting in a suicide as opposed to respecting her father's wishes. So we're looking at the question of death with dignity and what's happening across the country now. Short break. Your phone calls answered next on Connections. We'll be right back. right, welcome back to Connections. Let me grab Nancy in Pittsford. Nancy, go ahead.
Hi. My mother, I wouldn't say died. She didn't die. She was euthanized. Excuse me, 7 months ago, March 12th, and she was in the home of my adoptive daughter, and she had been knocked over by dogs, had a fall. And while in the hospital, my daughter had her designated hospice care. They sent her home. And I was invited to the house. I'd never seen the house before. My daughter just didn't want anything to do with me. And in the house, it was a party of death. And I know my mother's wishes. My mother had a new pacemaker. She was raring to go. She loved to go. She was a walker. She was smart. They said she had dementia, but she was wonderful company, and she was funny. And I adored her, and I know she wanted to live. She was in the hospital a few years ago with a nosebleed, and at Strong, they said, let's do a health directive. And my mother said firmly, I want to live. And she was a fighter. Now, Mom did not have cancer. She did not have anything more terminal than the fact that she was 97. But she had had bypass 10 years ago, and that gave her a new lease on life. And then the August before, she had a pacemaker, and she was terrific. So she had no broken bones or trauma. Now, they lied on the death certificate and said stroke. I know the doctors in the emergency gave her excellent care to prevent an embolism. And she only had bruises from that fall. She would have recovered. I wanted her in my home. I mean, she was wonderful. But her doctor judge, took him to see her a couple years ago, and I get the feeling he thought, oh, my God, 90 is really old. You're in overtime. And I thought, this is not the guy for, because we have longevity in my family. And I know he went along with that. They ground up some sort of pills and fed them in applesauce to Mom. And it was just, it was horrific. It was during the day of that horrific blizzard. And I asked for a lock of hair, and my daughter exploded with her terrible temper, and I was thrown out of the house and told never to come back again. I called the medical examiner. I called Strong. I called the funeral home that night, and I said, you'll be receiving a woman. Please, I want her autopsied, because in her body you will find no disease, but you will find a lethal dose of drugs. And they refused. The county medical examiner, his name was Hillen, he refused to do it. I called Strong. Dr. Goldstein said that, it was 2 weeks. I refused to let her be cremated. Then finally they said, well, any morphine or drugs in her body would be gone. But I haven't even done the obit yet. I'm so shocked and so angry about this. And I think she needed protection. When I went, I asked Strong to find that directive she had written that said, I want to live, a few years ago with the nosebleed, and they said they couldn't find it.
All right. So, Nancy, let me jump in and say that I've got to let Dr. Quill respond, but I also want to say, and it's a very sad story, and I'm not sure it's actually in the same exact sphere of our conversation, because we're talking about patients who are actively understand the scenario and are making choices. This unfortunately sounds like a very sad story that are outside the scope. And without more details, it's hard for me. I don't want to get into some of the names. What do you think?
No, I think this is just illustrative of just some of the challenges of making sense out of all the medical choices and all the different things that can happen to people toward the end of life. And it's particularly difficult if a person can't speak for themselves anymore, because we have to sort of work with families, and families are complex. And we do the best we can. We get together with everybody, and we try to make the best possible decisions we can, trying to respect the views and values of the patient if that person could speak for him or herself.
And Dr. Quill, Brian writes in asking, what can we do if advanced directives aren't being followed? And I'm going to ask Barbara the same question, but, you know, first of all, Dr. Quill has said on this program before, more of us should have advanced directives to begin with. Are they generally followed, Dr. Quill?
I would say generally, yes. The problem with advanced directives is sometimes they're so general that it's very hard to say if they apply with 100% certainty in a particular circumstance. So an advanced directive, which is setting out your views about what you'd want if you lose the ability to make decisions for yourself, are very important. But it's also really important to talk to your family, even if you fill out such a document, so that they really know what your views and values are, because they're going to have to be interpreted. And if there's doubt, generally we use aggressive treatment.
Barbara, what do you think about advanced directives after your experience?
Well, my family and I thought we had done everything right. My father had filled out his living will. He had named me as his legal health care power of attorney. He had a standing do not resuscitate order. So we felt we had, and he, my father felt he had planned and done the necessary things so that his end of life wishes would be honored. We never foresaw what happened, that, you know, a hospice would come in and overturn that, and then the police would agree with that, and then he would be forced to have unwanted treatment. And there really is no way to enforce that. I mean, it's a civil document, it's legal and it's signed, but if other people outside of the family decide to not honor that and invalidate it, they're able to do that. And the only redress is a civil suit, which takes years in the court, so it doesn't prevent what's happening in that immediate time. So that's pretty distressing to know that you go through the steps and take the time to do this and put all your wishes down. There was no disagreement within my family on what my father wanted. So it wasn't like a Terry Schiavo case. We all agreed to respect his wishes, and this still happened.
Having said that, this is a place where palliative care consultation can really help you out. So if you have somebody in the hospital that you love and care about, and you feel like their wishes are not being respected, you should insist on a palliative care consult, because we come in, we talk to everybody, we try to figure out what's going on. And if there's real conflict that we can't solve, we'll get an ethics consult. So there are ways of solving these things but you have to be pretty aggressive to do it sometimes, because medical people want to take over if they think they know what they're doing.
All right. We've got every phone line filled up, and let's try to move as briskly as we can, because there's a lot of people who want to weigh in. Tim in Pittsford, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Hey, Evan. I unfortunately have to agree with Dr. Quill about this summer getting into law, because God forbid our senators or local assemblymen don't get reelected because of it, which is completely selfish. But besides that, my father died in his early 50s. He had cancer that was discovered late. He had a cough for a while, and they found out he had a melanoma 20 years ago that all of a sudden it showed up 20 years later. Just cancer spread throughout his entire body. And they gave him 6 months to live, which, as the doctor probably knows, really means less than that, and it was. But to watch your real-life hero, this man who was the strongest person you've ever known, he was 5'11", 170, all muscle, to watch him be bedridden, lose probably at least 40 pounds, be a shell of his former self, barely able to communicate, and you could just see him trying so hard to be somewhat normal for him, but he was in so much physical pain. And at the end, 2 days before he died, he was going to go to hospice, and he said no. He just finally gave up. He was on morphine, so communicating at the end was really tough, but that was the only way to try and stave off some of the pain. He was still in plenty of pain. We had great health care. We had no issues with that at all. The end was just the end. It was inevitable. There was nothing else that could be done. He was pegged. There was no chemo, radiation that could be done. And for someone else to say, you know, I don't want anyone to go through this. Unfortunately, thousands of people go through this situation every day. But for someone from the outside to say, or try and make a decision and say, no, you can't do that for your loved one. I mean, I relate it almost to the abortion conversation of
someone else telling me and my family what they think they should be done, mostly from a religious aspect. My dad was Catholic from the day he was born till the day he died, read the Bible, went to church, all of that. But I can almost guarantee that if he had this option, just the look in his eyes, he would have taken it. He was so strong, but he just, after that long of fighting and fighting and fighting, he had no choice but at the end just to give up. And you almost wished that, I wanted him around as long as possible, but I almost wished that it had happened earlier because those last days were awful.
Tim, thanks for the call. Go ahead, Tim.
Thanks, Evan. No, it's always people from the outside who say, you should do this, you should do that. Well, when you're in that situation, you'll know a lot better, unfortunately.
Thanks for the call, Tim. And Dr. Quill, in this case, we've been talking about some family members have a hard time letting go, and you've been talking about the value of the patients knowing they have an option. Tim, in this case, didn't know exactly what his dad would have wanted, but he suspects his dad would have wanted the option, and the family might also feel comfort if a family member has an option. Is that also fair?
I think it is fair, yeah. I think people who are used to being in charge, who like to be in charge, that probably defines who has an interest in having these kinds of options at the end of life. If you're used to being in charge, you like to be in charge, you would like to be given some choice about this. Now, you might not exercise that choice, but if you have the option of stopping when you're ready, for folks who like to be in charge, that is huge. And even if you don't exercise it, you don't feel as trapped. You don't feel as out of control. You don't feel like you're subject to the wishes and powers of the doctors. So that is very important. And a lot of folks don't exercise it, but having it is important to them.
Let me get Justin in the city of Rochester. Justin, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Thanks for taking my call. Big fan. I'll just keep it short. I don't disagree with any of this. I think if it's your choice, I think it is your choice, and I think you should be free to make your choice. I'm mainly calling because I have a slight concern with some of the semantics that are being used in this topic, mainly not using the word suicide. I mean, that's what it is. I mean, it's just not a notion of suicide that we're historically used to, so we want to define it as something else. And I can understand that, but I mean, it really is. My biggest concern, I think, is in using the word brave. I just don't know that I would classify, I would use the word brave. I don't know. You'll have to forgive me here. I don't want to say it's taken the easy way out. I've seen it happen. I've got a family member that's gone through it. It's a bad situation. But I wonder if calling someone who's going to end it sooner and call them brave, if it lessens what other people have gone through until the end without taking their own life. And that's all I have.
Justin, thank you. Barbara Mancini, he's questioning whether ending your own life on your own terms can be called brave. What do you think?
Well, I don't know that anyone has the right to make that judgment about another person's decision. He may view that as the opposite of brave. Maybe he views that as a cowardly decision. He can have that opinion, but I don't think anyone has the right to make that kind of judgment on someone else's end-of-life choice. It's really none of their business.
I see all kinds of people on hospice who would never choose that option who are dying extremely bravely. I also see people who are exercising options like this who are dying extremely bravely. It really can be used as a descriptor for either kind of approach. It really is trying to keep people dying in a way that is consistent with their lives in a most meaningful way possible. So I think it can go as a descriptor in both directions. In terms of the suicide language, it is problematic. You know, in other languages, there are different words for different kinds of suicide. So there's heroic suicide, the soldier who jumps on a bomb to save the crew. There's mental illness suicide, which would be a different, and in other languages, there are different words. In English, there's one word for that. if we choose to call it suicide, it's okay with me. It gets confusing about, are we labeling that as mental illness, ending one's life, which we're not. But again, politically, there's a lot of controversy around language.
Kathleen in Rochester. Go ahead, Kathleen.
Hi. I was calling to speak about the different attitudes that you run into. I have been the healthcare proxy for my father, who died about 16 years ago, and am now the same for my mother, who has been in hospice, believe it or not, for 2.5 years and not died. And I feel that my dad died in a local nursing home, and it was at the end, he was in hospice care, and I was given at some point, you know, the knowledge that he was actively dying, but, you know, we can make him more comfortable if we give him more morphine. That may hasten his death, as it will make his breathing more difficult. And I opted to make him more comfortable. And during that time, he had a pacemaker, and I asked if his pacemaker could be turned off. I didn't want a part of him to die and another part to be still going. And it was, everybody was helpful and kind, and he went very soon after he was made comfortable. My mom is in a different situation. She has very, very advanced Alzheimer's. I mean, she just could lie in a bed. And it's confusing. It's more confusing this time because she's not refusing to eat completely. She can get down a little bit of baby food. But I've actually had the attitude, I have faced the attitude that I am not doing enough to make her die. Like, I should be asking them to not feed her, but she's accepting it, even though I think she's too far gone to not know or to make any decisions. I mean, she hasn't been able to communicate for years.
Yeah, Kathleen, we're running out. Let me let Dr. Quill jump in, only because we're starting to run out of time. Dr. Quill, Kathleen is describing a difficult situation in which she has to try to interpret what a loved one might want without being able to really communicate effectively. What do you think?
Yeah, it's really hard, and I don't envy your position. I do think that we try in these circumstances, if somebody can't speak for themselves, we're trying to keep them comfortable, that you can eat for comfort. So we stop paying attention to calories. We let them eat their favorite stuff. If they don't want to eat a given meal, we let it go and don't worry about those things. So everything is about their comfort and dignity. And that should be the driving force when you really don't know and you're trying to keep them comfortable. So it's not about keeping their nutrition up. It's about keeping their comfort and dignity up.
All right. Some closing comments real briefly. Barbara Mancini, from after your experience, what do you want to leave our listeners with to consider as we think about everyone in our own lives? I mean, death will come for all of us and our loved ones, as Dr. Quill has said, whether we like it or not. What do you want us to think about, Barbara?
Well, people prepare very well in advance for a birth in the family. Many times people aren't preparing for death, and we know that's a universal experience. So I'm glad that these issues have opened up the conversation about that. We need to pay attention to advanced directives that have some teeth in them, and very good, adequate hospice care. And aid in dying, I believe, should be legal and available in all states. And I'm hoping to be a part of the movement that will become an eventuality in enacting that legislation.
Barbara, thank you for your time today so much.
You're welcome.
Barbara Mancini joining us. It's the BrittanyFund.org that is helping now with some of that. And just 30 seconds, what would you say, Dr. Quill?
Hospice is the floor. So if you have somebody who's really sick, make sure they get hospice care, because that solves most of the issues. If you want to have or know what your options are in New York and you have a doctor, go talk to the doctor about how they see and how they would approach the tough situations that you're concerned about. Be as honest as you can and ask your doctor to be honest with you.
I'll close with two quotes from Epicurus. One, it is possible to provide security against other ills, but as far as death is concerned, we men live in a city without walls. And Epicurus went on to say, the art of living well and the art of dying well are one. Dr. Quill, would you agree with that?
Sounds very sensible to me.
Yeah, that's from 300 BC, and I think it applies pretty universally. Thanks for all the calls and comments, and Dr. Quill, thank you for your time as well.
My pleasure.
And thanks to John Andrus, our engineer. I'm Evan Dawson. Candidate Free Airtime is next on Connections.